strange buzzing noises. Am I standing in people's way? Probably. When I was 19 years old, I did a really stupid thing. I went skydiving. And I had never been in an airplane before. And so it wasn't the wisest thing I ever did. But a bunch of us got together, and as often happens when you get a room full of guys and testosterone levels go up, we kind of challenged each other, and then nobody really dared to back out. And so we went there, and we spent all day in Coolidge at the Coolidge Airport, such as it is, and we spent the day there falling off of moving pickup trucks so we could learn how to hit the ground and just doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And they didn't actually have equipment for me. Everybody else got a cool flight suit and a helmet thing that you know, like flight people wear. I got a football helmet. And then the flight suit didn't fit me, so I had the high water version of flight suit. And I looked pretty silly, and that photograph will never be shown at the Village, okay? I just promise you. And so we went there and we spent the day, and then the guy was going to give us our final instructions, the final instructions before we actually jumped out of the plane, and we had to get up, and I had to be first out of the airplane because I was the biggest, and so they needed to get rid of the weight and the size, and so I sat next to the door on my knees, a little Cessna airplane, and then we had to reach out when we got up there. We had to reach out and grab the strut of the wing, and then you had to take your right foot out, and there was a little bar that went out, and you stepped on that. And then you grabbed the strut with your other hand of the wing, and then you got out there a little further, and you had both, and then you had one foot trailing in the air, and you're hanging there, and then he reached over with a bat, and and he hit you on the helmet, which that's when the football helmet was a good thing, and to let you know that it was time to let go, and he was going to veer up and away, and so you wouldn't get killed, I guess. But before we got in the plane, he said, now, there's one thing you really need to know, and that's whatever you do, don't look down. If you look down, you will probably die of a heart attack. Because you will see the ground rushing up at you at like 8 billion miles an hour, and you will panic, and when you panic, you will do really stupid things. And we don't want you to panic because, like, there was any hope that we wouldn't. But we got up there, and he reached over and batted me on the helmet, and I let go, and I hit the end of this long line, and I got jerked up into the air, and my parachute was open, and I was drifting, and all was heavenly and wonderful. And then I thought, I wonder why you can't look down. I mean, he had said, keep your eye on the horizon. He said, look out, look up, look any way you want, but don't look down. But I thought, why would he tell me that? Like, I want to know why I can't look down. And you know how that happens. And so, because you're not allowed to look down, you just, oh, I got to look down. And so finally I looked down. Don't ever look down when you are parachute jumping. Whatever you do, look out, look up, don't look down. Looking down is really, really bad. And I panicked and I forgot all about the fact that we had a reserve parachute. And the reserve parachute, there was a little thing that, while you're flying through the air, you're supposed to stick this needle into this little tiny thing, and of course I have hands for that, and so you have to stick this thing in, and if you don't do that, then your reserve chute goes off, and then all kinds of bad things can happen. And so he said, look up so that you never, ever get panicked. Well, now I'm panicked, and I forget about that. My reserve chute goes off. If your reserve chute goes off, the chutes can get tangled, and you could die. That's what he had said. And or you could just drift, and you no longer have any control, and you could end up down in Mexico. And he says, you know, he told us these horror stories about taking dune buggies across the border and, I don't know, trying to track down wayward parachutists. But then he had said, if it goes off, he said, try to be smart and grab it and stick the parachute between your legs. And then you maybe won't die. And then don't look down anymore. And so then I hit the ground at 7 miles an hour, or however fast you actually hit the ground, which is really fast, which is why you had to keep falling off the back of the pickup truck. Anyway, I learned a lesson that day, and that lesson is to look up and look out, but don't look down. Okay? Just when they tell you don't look down, stop looking down. We're looking at Nahum, and Ron did a great job last week of just kind of painting the horror of all that's going on. I mean, you read this passage, this first part of Nahum, and you just see all the devastation and all the fearful, scary, horrifying, hideous, horrible things that are happening. And what's even more is these poor Jewish people are feeling really guilty because actually they're a participant in this, and they've agreed to do these things, and so there's just this devastation all around. And can I have a little clicker, because I'm going to have to maybe. But so we have this devastation that's happening, and so in the middle of that, Nahum writes these words, and it says, whatever they plot against the Lord, he will bring to an end. Trouble will not come a second time. They will be entangled among thorns and drunk from their wine. They will be consumed like dry stubble. From you, O Nineveh, has one come forth who plots evil against the Lord and counsels wickedness. This is what the Lord says. Although they have allies and are numerous, they will be cut off and pass away. Although I have afflicted you, O Judah, I will afflict you no more. Now I will break their yoke from your neck and tear your shackles away. The Lord has given a command concerning you, Nineveh. You will have no descendants to bear your name. I will destroy the carved images and cast idols that are in the temple of your gods. I will prepare your grave, for you are vile. Look there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, O Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. Pretty devastating time, and when you're in the middle of devastation, it's hard to do anything but just think about the devastation and to just dwell on that. And so there's some things that we need to know from this passage about what life is like in the devastation, but that in the middle of this devastation, the things you should know. I do not want to belittle in any way the devastation in so many of your lives. As a matter of fact, I want you to tell of the devastation of your lives. I want you to share it. I want you to offer it. I want you to give it to each other as a gift. It's true devastation. And I know that often in our devastation, we get to that point where we kind of think it's not only that we've been taken captive, and it's not only that we're in trouble, and it's not only that we're hurting and in pain and struggling and suffering and how scary and awesome the evil is that's all around us. Not only is that true, but we kind of feel partly to blame for it, like we did something, we're wrong, we messed it up, and we screwed it up, and so part of it's our problem. we're as guilty as, and we're being punished, and we're being afflicted. So in the middle of this devastation, one of the things you need to know is that God makes an end to it. Okay? It does not go on forever. I say that as a statement of hope and trust, not necessarily because it will feel like that. Okay? It doesn't always feel like it has an end. The promise of God is that this devastation that Nineveh, that Assyria is pouring down on these people who are just overcome and overwhelmed, they've gotten to the point, I suspect, where they just don't believe that there's an end. But the promise, God's promise, is there will be an end. It ain't over till God says it's over. Rejoice in that. Relax in that. Know that that's true. Know that no one rises up twice. I thought that was interesting as I read the passage and kind of got to thinking about it, that once God really deals with, when God deals with something, it's just dealt with. It's that same enemy, that same devastation, that same thing, God has dealt with that. That it doesn't come back. That God punishes it once and that's over. And you know what? That makes me feel pretty good, because in my sin, I think, and maybe you're like me, that you just think God's going to just keep punishing it and punishing it and punishing it because I did the wrong thing, I made the wrong choice, I did bad stuff, and God's just going to keep getting me and getting me and getting me, and every way it's just going to go on and on. No, God says no one rises up twice. That means I don't rise, my sin doesn't rise up twice. It's met and dealt with. For those of us who know, Jesus dealt with my sin. All sin is punished. That's true. It's either punished because I bear that punishment, or because I take Jesus' love and his compassion and his righteousness, and I take it for my own, and he suffers the punishment. But it never rises up twice. Though the enemy is full strength, they will be cut off and they'll pass away. God, this goes back to what we talked about before, that God is powerful. Often we don't think of God as powerful in these situations. We think of God as just not, as sort of either, you know, not engaged or, no, God's aware that they're at full strength, that they're offering the best that they have to destroy and to hurt and to cause pain, but they'll be cut off and they will pass away. It's interesting when he talks about passing away, it's as though they never were. The devastation of God against evil is so great, it's as if the evil never was. That's what God does. God's action toward us. He chooses to afflict us no more. These Jewish people who have just been attacked and mistreated and abused every way you can be would turn around and they'll say, God, you're the source of evil. You're causing us this pain. You're evil. That your devastation, that it's your devastation. And God says, no, I've afflicted you. Matter of fact, in this passage, he's talking about, though I've afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. That afflicting is an interesting phrase, because it's clearly God's intent to bring us testing and trial, and in that there's a lot of struggle. But like I said, there's an end, and this afflicting is not to death. And it's not to destroy. It's not to crush us or kill us. It's not to make us as though we never were. This afflicting of us is, it's, boy, I hate to use the word pestering because that's such a late word, but it's kind of that that building up of us in real trial and real testing. The affliction comes, and it's and that at some point he says enough. That for those he loves, which is all of us in this room, for those of us who he loves, he will choose to afflict us no more. It's done. God's action is also that he breaks the yoke. One of the interesting things about this was that people were actually excited about wearing the yoke of someone who was powerful, someone who was a king, someone who was strong and mighty. The yoke of the Assyrians was on these people, and it was like a king's mark on you. And it was a powerful mark. It was a powerful reminder that you belong to this Assyrian king, and that this, even though he was a tyrant, even though he was awful, horrible, at least you knew where you belonged. When God comes, he breaks that yoke. I think for many of us, that's a really hard time. When God takes the ownership that Satan and his forces feel they have over us, when he breaks that yoke, when he takes that away, when he destroys that, when that is no longer, he takes that yoke, he breaks it, which walks us into freedom, which walks us into a scary place, which walks us into a trusting place. That God will not allow us to bear that yoke. Now, with the yoke, of course, came burden, came responsibility, came taxation, came the right to be used and have their wealth and their, you know, the things they owned just taken over. It belonged to the king. The king could come and do as he wanted. And so this breaking of the yoke is a huge step. A lot of us wear that yoke and we live in that yoke. I know that's been true for me, that some of you have seen the painting that Sue did of the rocks, the bag of rocks that I carry, and the burdens that I've carried. And that painting I intended to bring tonight and then neglected to do is just one of those. It's just a reminder to me when I look at it of that yoke that I carry, but that yoke is now a choice. I can actually drop those rocks. I don't have to carry them. I don't have to hold them anymore. What's done to me and what was done to me and the slash of Satan against me no longer has that power. It no longer has the power. It's broken by what Jesus has done. He will snap the bonds. Not only was this yoke on them, but they're tied up, they're bound. I know so many of us feel that binding, feel that constant tied, we're just tied up in however we've been abused, however we've been mistreated, that just doesn't go away, that we're just tied up by that. And that God's action toward us is that he snaps those bonds, that he is in the business of tearing those apart. Now that can be a somewhat painful process, right? I mean, when ropes are getting cut and the bonds are being torn apart, it's scary. It's terrifying that God comes and he snaps those bonds, that his action toward us is to free us. God is always in the business of freeing us. He's always in the business of breaking yokes, of snapping bonds, and of choosing to afflict us no more. This is a hard one for me because I don't know if you're like me, you often kind of vow to remember forever the evil that was done to you, the slights, the horrible things that happened in your life. I will never, ever put myself in a position again. It's interesting that part of God's action toward us in this passage is that he wipes our enemies from our memory. He makes them as though they never existed. When you read about the cities of the plain, they're unnamed. We don't even know their names. Sodom, Gomorrah, all those cities were just destroyed. They don't even exist. What happens is in Nineveh, there's just two mounds that are all that are left of this great city. There's no memory of it. Like even a century later, there's no memory of this great city, the city that had huge influence, that was one of the meccas of the world, that was one of the most powerful places in the world. Literally, it no longer existed, and no one knew. I was reading one of the commentators, and he was talking about how years later, all these great conquerors would come through, great wars were fought, and people noticed those mounds, but no one knew the story of those mounds. No one knew why they were there. Literally, Nineveh was erased from the memory. All that to say that God invites us into freedom. That God's action toward us is to free us, to live free, to become free. I realize that I have lots of issues with freedom. One of my issues with freedom is that it obligates me to walk in freedom, to live free, to choose to act towards others as a free man, not to be bound again by what's bound me before, to choose to say no, while that once bound me, while that terror was once real for me, while that once was my way of being, now I will choose to walk in freedom. Walking in freedom is a huge trust issue with God, with us and God, and it certainly is for me, that I now have to choose to walk in freedom. I have to choose to be able to go parachute jumping and look down again, right? Because I know that I won't die. Well, I mean, I have some evidence that I won't die, because I didn't the first time. That real freedom is not, I will never go parachute jumping again and I will never ever look down again. No, real freedom is I can now parachute jump and I can look down and I can trust that that big old chute is open and slowing me down, tremendously slowing me down. I can trust that that's true. I have evidence. I have a past history. But that freedom, the first time we experience real freedom, it's really hard for us. And I think God understands that about us. That as he's freeing us and as he's freeing these people, he understands their issues with freedom. So he calls us, the call of this passage in Nahum is to look and to look up. It says, look up on the mountain. I love that that's true. I want to read this psalm. It's just been one of the psalms that I've always loved. Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming, your going, both now and forever. I love that. This looking up is hugely important, because the call to look up is hard. It's hard because we're stuck in the mire, we're stuck in the mess, we're stuck in the devastation, we're stuck in the pain, we're stuck in the middle of all the arrows that are flying around us and all that can happen to us. So the call to look up comes at a hard time. The call to look up is like God's desire for us to look up, to look out. What keeps us from looking up? The first one, a big one, is fear. What keeps me from looking up and trusting that God's coming, that good news is coming, that I am safe, that I'll be okay, is fear. Fear that it could all come back again. Fear that it could happen to me one more time. When I'm in the middle of my this call, when I'm hearing this call to look up, it always comes at a time when there is real evil that really could hurt me. I always love in Psalm 23 that the place of the banquet, the place of the presence of God, the table that is set where? In view of our enemies, right? It's not like the enemies just went away. It's not like it's all just disappeared. These Jewish people sitting in the city of Nineveh, they haven't seen the victory yet. The fear is real. The people around them are seeking to destroy them, to hurt them, to kill them, to do all kinds of damage to them. That's reality. One of the things that keeps me looking up is fear. Another one that keeps me from looking up is shame. The Jewish people had made decisions to invite other gods into their lives, to serve this wickedness, to bow before it, they had acquiesced. They'd given up. They, out of their fear, they had sinned, and out of that sin, out of that failure to trust God, they now feel a good deal of shame. I often feel that kind of shame. One of the great things that Satan does to destroy us is to remind us of the part we played in whatever was done to us. He is a master at that. And he will continue to remind us. So we have to continue to fight to believe that which is true about us. One of the reasons that we struggle with this shame is because the evil one will always make sure that he gives us a litany of all that we've done wrong. Part of walking in freedom is to deal with shame, is to lift our heads. Matter of fact, one of the names for God is the lifter of our head. I love that. One of the things that I have to deal with is the fact that in my shame, God is reaching down and he's lifting me up. When I first saw this painting that Susan had made for me, I could feel the shame wash over me. Like, I shouldn't be carrying these burdens. I should have let them go. I should know better. All those things. So that reminder of that shame is Satan saying, see, you never did have it right. You still don't have it right. You're still carrying those burdens. I don't see that the stones are falling out. I don't see that there's weapons there. I don't see all the beauty of what she really offered me, the gift that Susan gave me, which is to lift my head, to walk in the joy of what God's done and is doing, even when I don't necessarily see it yet or feel it yet or understand it yet or have hung on to it yet. Shame is one of those reasons why we don't look up. Unbelief. Some of us simply don't believe that God will ever come through. That God will it's just not going to happen. Maybe we've seen God come through for others, but we know that what we've done or where the place we're in, that God just simply won't do it. God's just not going to come through for us. He's just not going to be there. He just doesn't care. It's just, we just don't believe. I want to talk a little bit about that, because that unbelief is really, it's a scary, sad, and very lonely place to be. To choose not to believe is just a really scary place to be. But we often go there because it's easier to deal with my unbelief than to believe and not see it happen immediately, right? It's easier for us to just simply say, I'm not going to believe. It's a way of shutting down. It's a way of simply saying, I'm just not going to even enter that, because if I do, it will do what? It will raise my hope. And then if my hope gets crushed, then where will I be? So it's better to just not hope at all. It's just better not to believe at all. It's just better to not even see it coming, not even pretend it's going to be there, not even look up. Unbelief. Blindness. I think in a lot of ways, we're often blind to what God's doing in our lives. Like, I think, and when I look back on my life, I always think that God had these events, right? That there were these, like, there were just these events that now that I'm, 55 and I'm looking back on my life, I can say, well, God was there, right? But when I really think back about that story, I was just blind. Like, I didn't know that God was there. It wasn't some great moment when I said, oh, God's here and now I see. We walk in that sort of quasi-blindness. Some of you know that I'm not quite legally blind in my left eye and really have a lot of trouble seeing out of my right. And I was born with this sort of blurry vision, so that everything is just blobby. So when I do this, you have now turned into blobs. And some of you are kind of colorful blobs, and some of you are sort of drab blobs, and some of you are bigger blobs, and some of you are smaller blobs. But you all kind of blob together into this blobby mess. And so, but you know what? When I first got glasses on and I got to see, I actually ripped them off my face, because it was just way too much data. It was just way too much information, and it was just way too much to deal with. And so I chose blindness because it was what I knew. It was comfortable. I just didn't see it. I just never saw stuff. And that was a nice world. That blind world was a really comfortable world for me, because there were no expectations of me there. There was nothing pushing me or calling out any. So I just liked that little blind place. The calls to look up. I love that. Look. That look is an imperative. It's not a suggestion. It's not a, if you're tired of everything else, why don't you try looking? No, it's actually an imperative. Look! But the word look is with a great deal of excitement. It's very, it's full of energy, and it's full of, like, look! Look! Look up! Look at the good news. The good news is coming. When we look at this passage, we see that look on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. That whole looking up to the mountain is just hugely important. First of all, whenever the mountain is described, it's describing the glory and the power and the might and the strength of God. Okay? It's not like look up to the mountain is ever just, hey, look up there on the mountain. It's like, hey, look up there where God is acting, where God is, where God's work is being done. Look up. Like, see the mountain, see the power, see the might, see the strength, see the glory of God. the majesty of who God is. It's not about this looking down and seeing or looking out and seeing all the devastation around me. It's looking up and fixating, if you will, on God's power, his might, his strength, his ability to make amazing things beautiful out of all the devastation that's around. That is, my phrase here is, we must see the good news before we can know it. I got to talk to a philosophy class a couple times, and one of the things that I always enjoyed was getting into the debate of, they had to know things in order to believe them. So my challenge was, well, could I just believe things in order to know them? And they said, well, of course not, that's ridiculous, and I was stupid. But you know what, I don't think I am. I think that, you know, and Ron, you just, you know, you can debate it with me later on. I know you're the, you know, you have all that philosophy stuff, and you'll convince me I'm wrong, but I don't think I'm wrong on this one, okay? I think I'm actually right. I think that when I see, when I look up and see, and choose to look up and see, that in that doing that, I suddenly get to know. That knowing comes out of seeing. Knowing comes out of choosing to look up. Knowing comes out of choosing to look to God and saying, you know what, I really don't understand how you're going to do this. I don't really understand how goodness and peace and all those good things can come out of this devastation of my life. But I'm going to look up. I'm just going to choose to do that. And what looking up looks like, okay, it really is a lifting of the head. It's really taking us out of all the problems and devastation around us, looking at that and trying to analyze and figure our way out of it. Because that's what we're usually doing, right? When we're seeing the devastation, what are we doing? We're plotting a way out. We're trying to figure out how we can get out of this mess. It's almost always, when I've done that, it's almost always in my power, right? Like, okay, if I avoid that person, then I won't get hurt anymore. If I avoid those situations again, don't put myself in a situation like that again, I'll be more comfortable. It's we look at it from when we start getting all involved in that perspective, but the looking up requires us to say, okay, God, I'm really scared, I'm really terrified, I'm really in the middle of a mess, evil's all around me, things are trying to destroy me, I could die here, but I'm going to choose to look to you to be my rescuer, to be my hope, to be the one who's there for me. The one on the mountain brings good news and peace. Way back before there were things like the internet and things like computers and things like telephones, and even before things like the telegraph and the Pony Express, and like way back in history, like around this time in Nineveh, if you were winning a battle, you couldn't just radio headquarters and say, hey, we're winning, because, you know, they didn't have radios and hadn't been invented yet. And so it was kind of problematic. Like, how do you get the news out, right? How do you let people know we're winning? Or conversely, how do you know people to tell people, hey, we are getting slaughtered over here? Like, well, you sent runners out, right? And you sent really fast runners. And people who could run for long, long distances. And that required a lot of stamina and strength. There's another bad thing about messengers, and that's when they brought the message. If they brought the message to the king that it was good news, everybody partied. Not so much if you brought bad news, okay? If you bring bad news, you just get killed. So you could kind of tell by the way the runner was running whether he was really eager, you know, to come or not so much, you know. If he's running real slow, stopping to pick dandelions, you know, it's probably he's got bad news and he's putting off the inevitable, okay? But if he's excited because they've won the battle, then his feet are just flying. Because he's bringing good news and he's bringing peace. And that's what God's inviting us into, to see that Jesus has come, this one who's come eagerly, quickly, fast, with good news for us. That he comes that way. He is so excited to come for us in the middle of our devastation and in the middle of our pain. He is just running. Interestingly, he is the messenger who brings good news, gospel, and peace. By the way, when he brings peace, it's not what we often think of, the absence of war. This is shalom, the rich, beautiful Jewish word that means just overall goodness. Goodness for you, health, welfare, goodness of being, peaceful stuff. It's just all wrapped up. It's a much bigger word. Think big. Don't get lost in the littleness of the word peace. This is like really bringing not just peace, but goodness, complete goodness. And that Jesus comes, the interesting part is he comes that way, and he is the one who is destroyed. He comes as the bearer of good news, and he bears the bad news for us. Your sin is forgiven. Whatever your participation in evil was, it is forgiven. It's as though you never did it. The price has been paid. It is rubbed from memory. It doesn't exist anymore. That's amazing. Because I have a long litany of sins that I've done as recently as this week. And it's hard for me to just walk in the reality of the good news and the peacekeeping of Jesus, that those sins are forgiven. That the devastation that I have both inflicted on others and that has been inflicted on me has been taken care of by the work of Jesus, the one who brings good news and peace. So what's our response? First of all, celebrate. If that's really true for you, if you can actually look up and rest in that looking up, please celebrate. Matter of fact, the reminder here in the passage is, go back to the festivals. Festivals were festivity. I mean, it was fun. It was a party. It was a gathering of community to just celebrate the goodness of what God had done. Isn't it amazing that while the runner is still not yet there with the good news, the call is to celebrate? It's an anticipation of the reality of the goodness of God. Okay? That is an act of faith. To throw a festival in the middle of devastation in anticipation of God's work is an amazing act of faith. And that's, I think, what God wants from us, calls us to, invites us to trust Him that much, to celebrate our festival. Fulfill our vows, to honor the commitment that we've made to our God for Him to be our God. That's our vow. How do you fulfill a vow? Well, you do what you said you would do. You honor God with your life. You make sacrifices. You praise Him. You lift up His name. You share the good news of what He's done. All of those are part of the vow keeping that these people were invited back into, and we are. And finally, trust your freedom. and then trust the one who freed you. Maybe you're like me, and in the middle of your freedom, you get pretty scared. You get scared that it could all come back again. You get scared that it didn't really happen, that it didn't take. Trust is a choice in that situation. It doesn't feel like it always. Matter of fact, none of these things feel like choices. But trusting in the middle of the suffering, trusting in the middle of the pain, trusting that God will actually do what God says he'll do, in anticipation of him doing it, of looking up to see the good news coming, even though you're not sure yet exactly that it's there, but to see the signs of it and the tastes of it and the beginnings of it, and glom onto those with everything you have and just say, that's it. I'm going to take what little I have and I'm going to trust that. I'm going to trust the one who frees me, and I'm going to trust this freedom, and I'm going to be terrified the whole time. Comments, questions, thoughts, pushbacks, ideas? Yes. It is an awkward thing. I want to go back to that faith is a gift from God. You know, we don't go out and conjure up faith. We don't, okay, I'm just going to have faith now. No, faith is a gift. God gives it. He gives it freely. So I guess in that sense, we can ask for it. We can say, God, give me faith to see, but you're right. Sure. Right. That everyone agrees with the traffic laws. Yes, right.
So faith is really much larger than just belonging to the church.
Oh yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, I think that's why it's so interesting that it's an imperative, you know, because otherwise I don't think any of us would do it. You know, like I've been sucker punched and it's not fun.
Yeah. I just really like, I imagine if we kind of go with what Ron said last week about this being maybe a piece of propaganda that's passed around and families are huddled around reading it, and think about what God's calling people to do is to celebrate a reality that hasn't come, and as Ron said, isn't going to come for 40 more years. It feels a little foolish, but you also kind of think, oh yeah, there's a party at Elijah's house, and everybody, you know, like kind of passes it over. We're going to celebrate like what's coming, what's already like what we know is to be true, and that's sort of, you know, we see the runner, he's way on top of the mountain, and he's running fast, but it's going to be a while before he gets here. So let's celebrate, but it's still secret. It's still like it's very much our reality now.
Sure. Absolutely. And the devastation is real right now all around us. So while we're celebrating that, next door there's devastation going on. So let's close in prayer so somebody can go rescue their screaming child. Father, while some of us are rejoicing because we see the runner and we see Jesus and we see the beauty of what you offer us and you've lifted our heads when we couldn't, Father, still all around us there's devastation, and Father, I pray that we would look around us and see the hurt and see the pain, and that you would give us eyes to speak deeply into each other's lives and to love each other well. Father, I pray also that you would give us the ability to look up when we're afraid that even you might sucker punch us and that you won't be there and you won't protect us and you don't care about us. Father, forgive us when that's where our heads are. But know also, Father, that we are men and women and we are not God. We are not you. Father, thank you for being patient with us and for loving us and for calling us to look up and to hope again and to choose that. Father, thank you for your love. In Jesus' name, amen. As we spend some time worshiping, if you brought an offering tonight and would like to share it, please do so. If you're visiting, there's no expectation that you would do that. There's a chair back there called the sinner's chair if you're struggling with lifting your head up and would like people from the community to come and help you with that and to lift it for you, maybe. Then go sit there, either for the devastation that you've done or the devastation that's being done to you. Ask people to lift that up, and we will. Spend some time worshiping. If you know Jesus, if you know that he's the one who came on that mountain with the good news and the bringer of peace, and you know that you trust him, then come and take bread and juice, and as you take it, remember that his body was broken and his blood was shed for you. Let's spend some time worshiping.